And welcome to the Brad Pitt cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. My name is Dan.
My name is Joseph.
And today we're talking about...
Miserabilist Love Actually. That's what I've decided this film is.
True.
Yeah, like sad Love Actually.
Yeah.
And bad
Maybe love sadistic actually. Love Actually.
Yes.
Do you like Love Actually?
No.
Neither do I.
You don't like it at all?
Not at all. Not at all. I've seen it. I feel like... I didn't see it until, like, 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It became, like, a staple of a group of friends to watch around Christmas. So, like, obviously.
Yes.
But I hadn't seen it. I do have a friend who... This is just tangent.
Go on.
I have a friend who... I'm sure she won't mind me telling this. She was watching the film in the cinema. And you know that sequence where... the people coming into the airport and, like, greeting loved ones. Her grandma's just in that scene and she didn't know. So she's... And it's in the beginning, so she's settling in to watch this film. She's American and...
She literally had no idea that... That's so funny. Which would be...
That would be a weird collapse of reality.
Did she walk out and call her grandma and was like, what the fuck?
I don't know, actually. I should follow up.
The similarity, I think, between Love Actually and the film we're actually talking about today, Babel, and or Babel.
Babel, I think Babel, because that's...
That's where we get the word Babel from.
Yeah. TheBradPittCast@gmail.com if we're getting it wrong.
Yeah.
There's a... Not to... We're not sponsored by them, but there's a translation app, right, called Babel, and I think it's pronounced Babel, that is like... Or translational language learning, like kind of like Duolingo, I think.
Okay. What I think Babel and Love Actually share... is the fact that they are a series of interlinked stories, none of which have any conflict, really. I mean, like, Babel is heavy on a certain kind of conflict, but everything just goes the way that you think it's going to go.
Don't you think? I think that is true.
And that's my problem with Love Actually. It's why I think Love Actually is the most boring film ever made.
It's pretty boring.
Everyone in that movie is like, you know, the two porn stars, they're like, shall we go on a date? And they go on a date, and it's fine. And the English guy is like, I'm going to go to America and have sex with lots of women. And he goes to America and has sex with lots of women.
Which is kind of a good joke.
Maybe that is the funniest joke. You know, one of the women who he sees in the bar. Uh-huh. Oh, no, you haven't seen Mad Men.
No.
One of the women in the bar is January Jones, who plays Betty Draper,
who
is the best Mad Men character.
Okay.
So, very funny.
I think you in particular would
absolutely love it. We're really trying to not talk about Babel.
Yeah. Yes. Not only is there no conflict between them, but the MacGuffin that holds them together doesn't really do so in any way apart
from... In Love Actually or Babel?
In Babel. Both.
Oh,
well, I guess in Love Actually, well, it doesn't do so apart from it being like is just a function. There's no kind of thematic.
Babel just wants to, at the end, be like, hey, isn't this crazy? These stories are connected.
Yeah.
And they're connected in the laziest, least significant way.
We could come up, I think, like 10 minutes of brainstorm. We could be like, oh, it could be this.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, yeah, they kind of loosely know each other in a way that has no bearing whatsoever.
Yeah. It's like an object.
Yeah.
That is important. It's like, anyway.
Literally kind of Chekhov's gun stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Except it gets fired at the beginning. It's so... I was sitting next to Alana, my partner, during this, and I said, I think this might be the worst film I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah.
And you had never seen this film
before? I'd never seen this film. I'd seen 21 Grams as like a 17-year-old.
Sure.
And I think I thought it was fine, but looking back, I think it was probably terrible. Since I've developed a critical faculty, I didn't like Birdman. I think...
We have to point out the films you're mentioning are related by director.
Yeah.
Alejandro González Iñárritu.
I think Birdman is a tremendously stupid film.
Birdman...
And I think Babel is also very stupid.
Birdman may be one of the worst films ever made.
Yeah.
I really hate Birdman. And I hate the fact that it won Best Picture over Boyhood, which you haven't seen. Such a beautiful, like... Extreme. My partner Brianna is in the room but has headphones on so they can't hear what I'm saying, which is good because Brianna fucking despises Boyhood.
Oh, no.
Maybe their least favourite film ever made.
I just saw this on Twitter, so I'm not sure how recent the information is, but did you see that Linklater is making a film about Emerson and Ethan Hawke is going to play Emerson?
Seriously?
Apparently. Like, oh, it's on. He's slated to. I don't know if it's gone into production yet.
Wow. Linklater is such a weird filmmaker. Yeah. School of Rock is his, like, best-known film, and then he's just all over the place.
I always forget that's directed by Linklater.
He's, like, a better Steven Soderbergh,
yeah,
I think.
Sure.
He does, like, one for me, one for them. But
has fun, though.
Yeah, always has fun. Have you seen, like, Dazed and Confused?
No. I've seen Slacker.
Sure. You liked it?
Yeah, and Before Sunrise.
Oh, yeah.
And School of Rock. That might be it.
Okay. Lots of very good films.
Probably one or two other things, but
before,
yeah.
Before Sunrise. I mean, we've talked about it before.
It really beat me up. I saw that by myself at a cinema.
And walked around, like, sad for days.
Definitely.
It has that effect on you. Before we dive into Inarritu more, I want
to
talk...
Again, we're trying not to talk about it.
I know. I want to talk a bit about my history with Babel.
Please.
Which came rushing back to me as I was watching this film. So what year did Babel come out?
2006, I think. Thought...
So, we've said it on the podcast before, but, like, discovering movies for me happens in 2004 in a big way. So I have very strong impressions of movies that came out in 2004. Like Birth, Jonathan Glazer's Birth, like one of my favorite films of all time. That we talked recently about maybe doing an episode of for this podcast.
Because we did a pilot episode that remains unheard, which you may have mentioned before.
Which is probably... God awful.
Oh, I can't even imagine. I have the file somewhere.
Do you really?
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe we should listen to it. That would be funny. And so in 2004, I become a massive film watcher. I'm going to my local cinema all the time. I'm getting the little lobby cards, you know, those tiny little posters, gloss posters.
Yeah, they have them in a little plastic slot.
Yeah, and sticking them on my wall and going to my local
library. I did that a little bit, you know. Really? When I was just a very confused teen trying to, like, cast about for taste.
You were like, maybe I'm the movie guy?
Well... I don't know if it was even that sophisticated. I was just like, I like things. I think I saw a friend who had a bunch of stuff on their wall, and I was like, got to stop putting stuff on my wall.
What
and
did you have?
I have films that I still have. I had some films I still haven't seen.
Amazing. Like?
Though I had these great postcards that were all connected for the Red, White, and Blue trilogy.
Oh, beautiful.
And so that was on my... Even though I was like, I got to see those films. But also, I wasn't really illegally downloading stuff. And there's just no way to access them.
No.
Like, they weren't in my Blockbuster, so I was like, well, what do I do? You know, I wasn't ordering DVDs online or anything.
Kids today...
I know.
...don't understand when you just can't find shit. Like, you just couldn't watch stuff.
Maybe a Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which I had liked. I think I had a lobby card for that.
Great film.
I kind of very scattered, which probably comes out a bit in this podcast, but kind of, like, whatever was put in front of me...
Yeah,
that I'd be was like, well, it. This is definitely a... what's it called? Let the Right One In as well.
Oh, which I loved.
I was obsessed with that film. I watched it. It was one of those films where I was like, I have to show everyone this.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you seen the American remake?
Let Me In? No.
It's not bad. It's actually not bad.
Okay.
It's different, but I quite like it.
Hmm.
And part of me becoming a film lover was going to my local library and borrowing copies of Sight and Sound magazine, which is like a very hoity-toity British magazine, which is... pretty snobby, to be honest. Like, now I think I would find most of what they write fairly reprehensible because they would hate any movies that I like. Although there's a really great British horror critic called Kim Newman, who for decades has written a column for Sight and Sound about, like, gross, grotty horror movies.
Sure.
So they do have some coverage, but they're mostly snooty. And I remember them waxing lyrical about Babel. It was their cover story.
Wow.
And they loved it. They loved Inarritu. I read this long profile of Inarritu where, so I know weird stuff that all came rushing back. Like, this film was inspired by a dream, which is crazy because it's kind of the least dreamlike film.
Yeah.
He dreamt he was a Japanese schoolgirl at a club, unable to hear people speaking, which is kind of the centerpiece of the film.
Yeah, it's one of the more interesting sequences.
Because it's interestingly directed.
Yeah, it is.
And then he built a film around that, basically. And decided along the way that...
Morocco.
And also that this film would have its terrible thesis.
Really awful. Same as Birdman, which has... This is Reviewers Suck.
Yeah.
And 21 Grams, which is like... We all have souls, I guess.
I guess so.
Again, it's been 10 years.
21 Grams. Spoiler alert for 21 Grams, which you probably don't need to see.
I don't remember it. And you don't, I'm sure. Yeah.
21 Grams is told out of order. It's and very much like Babel, it's these interlocking stories. And Sean Penn he's got a failing heart, and he gets a heart
that's right.
transplant from Naomi Watts' dead husband. It's very, like, miserablest drama. Everything is so difficult and hard. And the funniest thing that happens in 21 Grams is during this incredibly intense dialogue exchange between Naomi Watts and Benicio del Toro, that's kind of the climax of the film, Sean Penn just randomly shoots himself. Do you remember this?
No.
He just pulls out a gun and just shoots himself in the heart. and he goes and dies, and that's basically the end of the film.
Huh.
They're just, like, the most insane decision. Like, he is just like, oh, fuck, I'm sick of being in 21 Grams. I've got to get out of this movie. Inarritu is, I think, someone who maybe looms large on our generation, weirdly, because he was kind of becoming famous when I was first getting into movies.
Yeah, and was kind of a crossover director, like had made a bunch of Mexican films, right? Mm. And
Amores Perros, which is his first film, which I think is his best. Have you seen that film?
No.
So he's got one thing that he likes to do, and that's interlocking stories.
Sure.
And Amores Perros is about people in their relationship with their dogs.
Oh.
So I actually...
That sounds interesting.
Love it.
It also sounds like it would be a good film for Inarritu to make, because I don't think he's interested in people beyond performance. So true. Dogs are, like, great because they're inscrutable in some capacity, and so he might be interested. Like, that seems like an interesting thing for Inarritu to direct.
He's also, in Amores Perros, he leans very heavily into the fable-like quality of the story.
Yeah.
Which I think works for him because he is a director who is unable to work in specifics.
Yes.
So he's at his best when he's painting real broad. So my favorite story in Amores Perros, there's three stories. My favorite is the third one, which is the story of an old man who collects stray dogs from the streets of Mexico and looks after them. And he finds this new dog that he loves, brings it home, goes out for the day. And when he comes back, the new dog has killed all the other dogs. And he basically pulls out his gun and he's deciding whether to kill this new dog. And he decides not to. And that's like the whole segment, which is like, of course, a very stupid, obvious metaphor for, like, you know, the trust you have to place in letting new people in your life.
Yeah.
But it's so...
That's an interesting human decision.
Yeah.
To some extent.
Yeah. It's just big, vague signifier that fable-like you can read whatever meaning you particularly desire on top of.
Mm.
Babel also wants to be that.
At a grander scale.
I think this film's problem is that thinks it's telling intimate human stories on the broadest possible scale, but is actually just so vague as to be a soap opera.
Yeah, but like at least soap operas know what are aware on the level on which they're operating. Like they're interested in kind of relationships as relationships and conflict. And this is just this because it. I think Inarritu's big downfall in this and Birdman at least is too. I assume the same problem exists in 21 Grams, is that he thinks he's so much smarter than he is. It's a huge gap, and I think it's the kind of thing I find most unforgivable in art. Like, just be aware of your capabilities and be humble about your capabilities.
He thinks he is a genius.
Yeah.
He thinks he is so smart. It's deeply problematic.
Yeah, it's a real... It's a fatal flaw.
Yeah. It's very interesting, too, and maybe this will be... I'm not lumping these people together because of nationality, right? But they call themselves the Three Amigos.
Mm-hmm.
Three Mexican directors, all of whom have won repeatedly very big gongs at the Oscars and are all friends, are Inarritu, Alfonso Cuarón, who made Gravity and Roma, and Guillermo del Toro.
Huh.
And it's very interesting that Cuarón and Inarritu are both kind of technical innovators who then made a very personal story about, like, the, you know, triumph of the human spirit that the Oscars loved. So, like, Roma and basically Babel and everything that Inarritu has done, I think, falls more in that category. And I think they're terrible films. I also hate Roma.
I quite like Roma.
I think there's one good scene in Roma. Do you know which one I'm going to say?
Is the yoga one where they're all, yeah...
There's this,
that is a good scene.
This housekeeper goes to this big...
Well, it's not yoga, but it's something like that.
Yeah, she goes to this big field where there's a kind of, like, miracle man who's trying to get everyone to do this thing where they stand on one leg and kind of look into the distance, and no one can do it, and you cut, and that housekeeper is doing it very gracefully, and no one has realized that she's done it. I think the rest of that film is boring and miserabilist porn, which is, like, what Babel is.
Which I am normally really sensitive to. Maybe a rewatch of Roma would. There was some reason I didn't think that was the case when I saw it.
I think I have the problem also with Roma that was highlighted to me by our friend Ned.
Mm.
Ned watched that film and knew it was an autobiographical film from Cuaron, but assumed that Cuaron was the son of the housekeeper.
I thought that too. And actually, I saw it with Ned.
Actually, he was the son of the fucking rich.
Yeah, that's, and I think I thought that when I thought that when I was watching it.
Yeah, makes it creepy.
Yeah.
Like, so that, I suddenly realized that my housekeeper had an internal life.
That's, I agree with that. May have changed the way I looked at it if I'd known that going in. I think it's quite a beautiful film. It doesn't need to be black and white necessarily, but I do think it's quite a beautiful film.
I don't know. I hated that movie.
Yeah.
And you hated Babel.
Well, there's a scene towards the end, a couple of scenes towards the end that kind of just turned me around a little bit.
Are you talking yourself into doing a four-sentence game? I think you are.
When I was watching this, I was like, absolutely not.
You can do it in very broad brush strokes, right? Yeah, you probably can. Right? Go on.
Two kids in Morocco are playing with their father's gun and shoot a tourist bus holding Brad Pitt and his partner, Kate Blanchett, hitting her in the shoulder and severely injuring her, let's say. Meanwhile, or not meanwhile, but also in Japan, yeah. Like temporarily... Oh, actually, it is kind of meanwhile. What on earth is that story?
Nothing.
Well, you kind of have to go to the end to work out why it is linked, right?
And it's not even really linked.
Well, so her father gave the gun to the man
who's that?
In Tokyo, or at mm-hmm. least in Japan, I think in Tokyo, a deaf Japanese girl... Well, kind of the crux of her story. In Tokyo, a deaf Japanese girl is teased for being a virgin and then seems, in a kind of way that clearly showcases some experience of trauma,
mm-hmm.
tries to have sexual relations with a series of people, including some cops, including one of the two policemen who come to talk to her father about something that turns out to be... the gun that her father gave to a man in Morocco, which was sold to the father of the two children who shot Kate Blanchett accidentally.
The stupidest, most tenuous connection. I think there's a version of this film that I respect where that Japanese storyline is completely disconnected from the others. Because, I mean, it seems insulting that the connection is... her dad, who we don't really know or care about, once met someone and gave someone a gun... The stories don't have any bearing on each other.
Literally been anyone on Earth whose father went on a hunting trip in Morocco and gave that man the gun.
It could have been me. It could have also been that, like, just in one scene, a postman delivers a letter and it turns out he's the connection. It's so lazy.
It doesn't really... Did I read this on the Wikipedia? Oh, we gotta get to this. But do you know who loves this film?
If
who
you're gonna say fucking Roger Ebert...
I think... I gotta look this up because actually... Let me keep doing the four sentence game while I look this up because who cares?
Yeah, genuinely, who cares?
What's the other story? Oh, that's
Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett's housekeeper
who
very
is
very Roma.
Yeah, who is Mexican,
mm-hmm.
but also her only character is that she is Mexican. Like that's which is
100%, which is wild because this is Iñárritu's heritage that he's doing a very bad job of representing.
Has to look after Brad and Kate's kids. Are they like in... This is just a side track. Are they in like a border town? They don't...
I guess so.
Somewhere that you can drive to Mexico. Is it, I guess, California?
Yeah.
Maybe.
I must be. Because Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett are very wealthy.
Yes. So they have this housekeeper who has taken care of these kids. She needs to go to a wedding in Mexico because... I mean, also... were they going to be back in America by the time... I guess from Morocco... Because it seems like she's set into crisis, so like, oh no, oh, but anyway.
Well, useless to even unpick.
She takes the two kids to a wedding in Mexico, but in bringing them back, gets stopped at the border because the man who is driving them...
Garcia Bernal?
Yeah, gets in trouble with the cops and just drives into the middle of the desert, abandons the housekeeper and the two kids. The housekeeper gets picked up by... ICE, a cop, something, and gets deported. She thinks she's lost the kids, but they were found in some other way. So that's three sentences. I know they're very long sentences.
Extremely long.
The fourth sentence is Brad Pitt kind of manages to look after Kate Blanchett in this little village they've been taken to until a US helicopter can come and take her to a hospital. And you find out, because the Japanese cop is watching it on television, another bullshit connection, that she recovered. That's the movie.
So the movie, I mean, we have to say up front, in case we haven't made it clear, The movie has a very silly central thesis, which is people struggle to communicate with one another.
Which the story of Babel, right, from the Bible, is that God is like, as punishment gives people...
They're building a tower that's too high, and God's right. Like, I've had enough of this.
Getting above yourself. You're trying to get above me.
Yeah.
You've all got to speak different languages.
And so they can no longer build the tower, because there's a breakdown in communication.
Yeah.
And so the stories... every single one of the miniature stories is basically about a failure to communicate. So the deaf girl can't speak to her father, right? She literally can't speak in a very... ableist and unfortunate turn that Inaritu makes that we have to talk about in a sec. Inaritu has this controversy about him, about ableism, that we'll talk about in a minute.
It's not unsurprising, though.
No, because he only thinks of people as kind of what they mean. We'll talk about this in more detail after the ebook quote, right? But I watch a lot of horror movies, and horror movies get talked of as exploitation movies. Babel, to me, is an exploitation movie, in the very literal sense of that term.
Something I thought a lot about watching this film is how much it makes me appreciate your critical respect for horror films. Because this is the kind of cruel that people, when they say, why would you go to a horror film to be scared? This is the film that has that problem.
Yes.
It's like, well, why would you watch Babel to be traumatized in a way that is meaningless?
To see
horror films are actually much more compelling, if not thematically, at least formally.
Yes.
Because they're, like, doing things within a genre that is interesting, and they're, like, playing on it in some capacity, even if it's kind of exploitative, scare quotes. But this is a exploitation film that is distressing to watch and is punishing its audience, often. And I think that this is a question where this is a film where that question deserves to be asked of it. It's like, well, why would you punish yourself with this film?
The housekeeper subplot in particular.
I think that's when I said to Alana, this is the worst film. This might be the worst one I've ever
seen. It's so unpleasant. She is so sad. She's having such a rough time. And you just go like, for what?
Yeah.
Why? For what?
At least, like, there were moments in the Moroccan storyline I felt that as well. But that is a little more organized and has just a smidgen, the tiniest amount of heart.
Yeah.
In that you feel like the kids are having a rough time when they're being chased down by the police.
You feel for the kids.
Yeah, there is we'll get more to the things that maybe turn around. Just the tiniest bit, maybe take this film from half a star to one star. Mostly Brad-centric.
What does Ebert have to say about this film?
Thank you. Sorry, I'd forgotten I was waiting to say that. The film critic Roger Ebert, this is from Wikipedia, included Babel in his The Great Movies list.
Fucking
stating that, what a anodyne name for a list.
Yeah, fucking
stating that the film, quote, finds Inaritu in full command of his technique. The writing and editing moves between the stories with full logical and emotional clarity. And the film builds to a stunning impact because it does not hammer us with heroes and villains, but asks us to empathize with all of its characters.
What the fuck?
But only because none of them have any traits.
No.
So it's not interested in heroes and villains in the same way that it's not interested in character.
No.
It's interested in people as functions of, like, storytelling and, as you say, meaning.
Yeah.
But in the most boring sense of the word.
True. It's just like, here are some people, get some good actors to play them, and then have awful things happen to them.
Yeah, so there can be machines for messages, which you don't need a film to convey this message. Tell me a message that you need a film to convey. Don't just say, like, hey, you know, often miscommunication sucks.
Yeah,
thank you. I now understand that phrase. I don't need to watch this film. It doesn't add anything to that basic claim.
No. I maybe it's unsurprising that Ebert liked this film, because he has that quote that people love from Ebert, which is like, movies are empathy machines. And I can't think of anything that describes worse my experience with watching movies.
If I think of my most... the film, like, just off the top of my head, films that I love. This is Spinal Tap. Burning.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm interested in that film.
No. I think cinema and we...
A New Leaf that we watched the other night. But that's not its point.
No.
At all.
I think the thing that makes cinema great is that it's just... images, dreamlike images.
Yeah. Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
Not an empathy machine.
No. Francis Ford Coppola said that movies are his favourite art form because they're the ones that most resemble the way that the human imagination works.
Yeah.
Like pictures, sounds, like you get it all. And I think that's more what I feel. Like,
Movies
can be dreams in a way that, like, literature, for example, I think struggles to be like a dream in the way that a movie like Mulholland Drive can be a dream.
I think that's fair. I also think that's because movies are imposed on you in a way that literature isn't, and in a way that your dreams are.
Mm.
Like, when you're dreaming, you don't feel like you're creating them the way you maybe need to feel you're part of a collaborative process in reading. It's not really being thrust upon you, but films are kind of thrust upon you.
They happen.
And then you
to
emerge
you.
From them, and then you're like, what?
Yeah.
What was just done to me?
Yeah.
Which is kind of how you wake from dreams. It's not... I mean, there are books that resemble that, and books can be rich in their own way, but it's not really that way.
No. Should we do the ableism thing briefly? Well, I think it's just to say...
Yeah, what's the actual...
The charge is just that Inaritu...
I mean, I'm not trying to defend Inaritu here.
Inaritu has a message of this film, and the message of this film is people struggle to communicate, and he literalizes that in the most embarrassing, tokenistic way.
Yeah.
By being like, here is someone whose struggle to communicate is based on the fact that they're deaf.
Yeah.
And it's...
And then, but it then extrapolates that into a more existential struggle to communicate, which depends on her deafness, which dehumanizes her.
And I think the big thing for me is that that's what I mean about exploitation. And it's true, I think, of every Inaritu movie. It's actually why I think the best Inaritu film, better than Amores Perros, maybe. Have you seen The Revenant?
No.
I like The Revenant.
Okay.
I know a lot of people really, really don't like that film. I was like amongst the circle of my friends, I was the one who thought it was pretty good.
Do you think I'd like it? Does it try to be meaningful?
No.
See, that's... I can imagine watching an Inaritu film that wasn't trying to be meaningful.
Yeah.
And having a fine time.
And that's what I mean, right? Like, I think he is, more than any mainstream accepted filmmaker, an exploitation filmmaker. In that he...
Yeah.
His movies are about doing terrible things to people, using people as...
props?
Yeah. Using people as, like, fleshy props. We've got cars starting out the front. It's all happening. He doesn't care about people for the sake of people. He cares about wringing a message out of them. And the good thing about The Revenant is he loosens his grip on the message. So you could say that film's about certain things, like Leo on the press tour when he was trying to generate some kind of narrative would say, like, it's about climate change, you know, he had to do that. But it's just a very mean-spirited, very long and very difficult film in which horrible things happen. It's, again, not to draw them close together, but it's a lot like Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity.
Which I haven't seen.
Which you really should.
Okay.
I really like that movie. James Cameron described T2, The Terminator 2, as 10 miles of bad road. And I think The Revenant and Gravity are 10 miles of bad road. They're just like, you know, like rough,
sure,
difficult experiences that you kind of just generate catharsis out of because you've just seen awful things happen for 2.5 hours.
Which actually is kind of what Babel is as well.
But it wants to fucking academize itself.
Yeah.
It wants to tell you this is all for some fucking grand purpose. Did your partner Alana watch the whole thing?
No, she watched like the first half hour. And you know what, because we watched Contagion a while ago. And one of the first things, I said, this reminds me of, and she said Contagion. And there's something about this, was Contagion made like 2008 or something?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
It's this, I don't know if this kind of film is getting made currently, but this kind of, everything is somewhere between brown and blue. And
that's,
you've got a lot of shots
Soderbergh
of households.
That's, yes.
And then, and like, people in rooms, and then very intimate and shocking drama that takes place on a kind of human scale, but doesn't feel like it needs to make itself interesting, only feels like it needs to make itself a kind of a cross between realistic and challenging and meaningful, which both those films kind of do. And I'm sure there are others, like, I think 21 Grams is probably kind of in that vein as well.
I think it's fucking Soderbergh's fault.
Yeah.
I think it's like Traffic, Traffic effect.
Yeah, which I have also seen. And I think I hired Traffic and 21 Grams from the Blockbuster, and I don't, like, look, that's like 10, 12 years ago. My brain has totally merged those films.
Yeah.
And I think it would have done the same with Babel if I'd watched it then too. And I think it's just, it's a really, I don't know, like, the kind of your vision of what cinema should be, I cannot think of anything further from it, which is, like, it really is just, it feels like it feels so obligatory and and demanding on its audience, not in any kind of intellectual way. Because it's also obvious as well. Like, same with Contagion. It's like, here are the archetypes, and here's how they play off against each other. It's got, like, a bunch of... You've got, you know, 15 movie star names on the poster, and that's why people turn up. But then it tries to teach you a lesson.
I think I like Contagion okay because...
I shouldn't say... I'm mad at Babel. I don't hate Contagion.
I think Contagion is kind of... I don't think that's a great film, because I don't think Soderbergh has ever made a great film. But I think he puts a lot of parts in motion and then just goes like, let's see how this plays out.
Yeah.
And that's kind of interesting. There are also
good performances in that film.
Because there's complexity to Contagion.
Yeah.
And as you say, Babel reminds me a little bit of... the films of Darren Aronofsky. Babies. Inarritu is a baby, and so is Aronofsky, and they just have the worst conception of what it means to be quote-unquote serious. You said that there was stuff that turned you around on Babel. I think I have to say, I mentioned it before, but there's this scene that Inarritu got from his dream, which is the deaf girl at a disco, and it's cutting from her point of view, which is totally silent, to a mid-shot of her, which is very loud. Yeah. So it does kind of fun things with
and
sound.
And it's like, I love being in a claustrophobic dance scene.
Yeah.
That's something I often think, it's one of my, like, a film I love and I've talked about, The Great Beauty.
Mm.
There's like a couple of really fun, like just so much fun. I love a film that is just willing to have a lot of fun. And I think being in a dance, and there's the opening of a film which I haven't actually seen all of, but I watched like half an hour of it a while ago and enjoyed the opening. Is it Miami Vice?
They're just...
Great.
Open.
Jay-Z Lincoln Park?
Yes.
Excellent
opening. Unbelievable. Unbelievable opening. There's no title cards. There's nothing. Miami Vice just literally opens with people dancing. Yeah, yeah. Incredible. There's also a really good club scene in David Cronenberg's Cosmopolis, which is about...
I've got to watch that film. I've read
really
the book.
You really do. It's unbelievable. I love that book.
It's a good book, yeah.
I love DeLillo when he's snipping the meaning out.
Yes.
You know, which relates nicely to Babel. Like, I think DeLillo is at his least successful, and he doesn't do it often, where he wants to be like, this is the point.
Yeah.
Something like The Names, like an early book like that I don't like that much, is he saying, like, this is what this book is about. And he's so fun when... He writes Underworld, and it breaks him because he doesn't want to write books. And so he just writes these small, oblique, weird novels that don't mean anything.
Love it.
Point Omega, right? Like
people in desert, for some reason.
For some reason, doing something, and then it's over.
Like, good sentences.
Yeah, but beautiful, nice to read, that's it. What turned you around on Babel?
The scene where Brad Pitt is in the hospital corridor, and he's on the phone to his kid... And the reason Inarritu thinks it's meaningful is because you've heard this conversation earlier. And
From
the other side. And you don't realize... So he calls the nanny. And this is... So this is the kind of... One of the... It's not even a reveal because you kind of know it's happening. But it's kind of played like a reveal. Which Brad Pitt calls the nanny before she goes to Mexico. While she's just looking after the kids. And tells her, like, don't tell the kids, but my wife's been shot, etc. She's like, they're in the hospital, she's about to be operated on, and his kid starts, and I'm almost actually getting emotional talking about it because it's such a moving performance, even though I do not care about the film that surrounds it. He starts talking to his child and then starts to well up, and the kid says, are you okay? And the child's just talking about something that happened at school that day, and he like flips the receiver around and kind of leans into the wall and just is weeping while his child is just telling him about what happened because he wants to hear his kid's voice. He plays that so well. He could overdo it, he could underdo it. It's exquisite. It almost feels like a turning point for him cinematically, because I think he's okay at the beginning of the film. Who knows what order it was shot in, but he gets better throughout as he needs to be more commanding and more embodied and infuriated because the tourist bus that has brought him to the town is full of these kind of British, like...
Evil people. The most evil people in cinematic history. His wife has just been shot and they are refusing to help. Yeah,
they're like, oh, there's people who need their medication and we got to get it. Like, in a way that does not seem urgent.
No.
Like, we've got to get on the bus. Like, obviously racistly saying that if we stay in this town, you know, we're not safe here. And it's just like a bunch of like pleasant villagers who are trying to do their best. Brad is kind of both being very controlled because, you know, he has to do everything he can to get his wife medical attention, but at the same time, obviously, like, losing his mind because his wife is dying from a gunshot wound. He's good in this film, but that scene towards the end, I found, and not, like, to some extent, it's like, of course that's going to be a moving scene, just descriptively, but he does a lot with it.
I think we're now, from this point on, and it's a conversation we should really save, I think, in quite a lot of depth for Tree of Life, because that's what he does there. We've always said that Brad is, like, big and baroque and oversized. But he's basically, up to this point, only played that in a kind of, often for comedy or to make himself feel like an alien. And around this point, he does this weird kind of magic trick where his performance in Babel is almost a caricature. Like, he's very squinty.
Kind of looks like Inarritu.
Yeah.
I think he's kind of done up to look like Inarritu a bit. Like, his face is kind of a bit, like, squarer, and his stubble is done. And he is squinty.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is that crazy?
No. I mean, directors always style their lead to look like that. It's like
the Christopher
like
Nolan thing,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Leo in Inception. Yeah. Like, and Kyle MacLachlan in Blue Velvet is styled exactly like David Lynch. The haircut is the same. Yeah, you can't not make your main character look like you, apparently. So he is very oversized, but I think from here on, and he does it also in Tree of Life in a big way, it feels oversized in the way that, like, people who are oversized caricatures can exist in the real world.
Definitely.
And from this point on, I think Pitt starts playing oversized people like they exist naturalistically.
Moneyball, Burn After Reading.
Yes.
Yeah. Killing them softly.
Yeah. And I don't know what the change is.
You know, I think this is the first time this... And it feels like part of this is kind of makeup and how he styled for this role. But this is the first time from Ocean's 12, Mr. and Mrs. Smith to Babel is you could... You wouldn't call him old, but you could call him old in some context and it wouldn't be wrong. Like, it would be odd to call him... I think you could call him youthful in every single performance up until this one.
Mm-hmm.
And it would not make sense to call him youthful in Babel. And I think you could call him youthful again in, you know, Burn After Reading or whatever. Like, he goes back to that. But I think he captures something of age that permits a kind of undercutting the sensibleness you expect to come with age, but still carrying himself in a way, like, with the weight of age.
He's wearied. And yeah. I don't think he's ever played weary before.
No, I think that's right.
Literally. I mean, he's played sad, right? But it's not the same as... Maybe Sleepers, he's weary adjacent, but
and
he's barely
like,
in that
film. Even in Ocean's 12, when it's like, I guess I gotta go back to the old me, it's still not... That's not because he was worn out.
Yeah.
It's a choice.
Yeah.
There's, like, he hasn't been... He's harrowed for the first time. Like, time has forced him to make choices for the first time in this film. I don't know if that's happened before.
Is this also the first time we've ever seen him with children?
Do you mean as a father or like with kids at all?
As a father.
That's interesting. That hadn't occurred to me.
Maybe. It must be, right?
That's so interesting. It's fascinating. Like, the choice in Mr. and Mrs. Smith for them not to have kids is an interesting one.
And for the film to be like slightly anti-child is very interesting. But he's a great performance. I think we should also say too that he and Cate Blanchett, his wife, are estranged. I think if I were to rank the subplots in this film, my favourite is Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett.
Yeah.
My second favourite is the Moroccan children.
Yeah.
My third favourite is the Japanese girl. And my fourth favourite is the maid going to Mexico. And there's a sharp drop off from two to three. Because I quite like the kids, and I ultimately quite like the Brad Pitt, Cate Blanchett, and I fucking hate the other two.
I went on holiday, well, like one of the better holidays of my life, to Japan in early 2019. It's nice to just look at Japan. That's the limit of what I can say about that sequence.
And kind of like competently shot. Maybe the best shot
subplot.
Yeah, I think
that it does feel... And also there's something of... a kind of interest in... He manages to be relatively good at being interested in a range of cultures without overly exoticizing them. I think you could say that about the Japan and Moroccan... And, I mean, Mexican, obviously, he is from Mexico. But Japan and Moroccan sequences... There's a little bit of... The Moroccan one has more kind of white saviory stuff going on.
And the music. And
that's true. The shorthand.
But it's not... No, I broadly agree with you.
It's not the Mexican.
No, exactly. He doesn't have... We should specify you mean the Brad Pitt film, the Mexican.
Sorry, within canon on this podcast.
He doesn't do the Soderbergh thing of, like, slapping a different filter on it for a different country.
Yeah, and he also doesn't make a huge deal out of anything culturally distinct about...
No.
In the sequence with the children in Morocco or in Japan.
No.
I think.
This could really be a film that emphasizes, like, miscommunication between cultures... as part of its stupid thesis. And it's actually largely not. Like, the cross-cultural breakdown is not really ever very important. The breakdowns in communication are more like, Brad Pitt doesn't honestly tell his maid, like, listen, I need you, and she doesn't honestly say, look, I'm meant to be going to this wedding, right? They, like, talk past each other.
Which is interesting, but is not handled interestingly.
No. People miscommunicate when they're speaking the same language, not when they're speaking different languages, which is maybe also quite stupid, because it makes the thesis more fucking hit you over the head. But it at least means the film is largely not racist. Largely.
Yeah, it definitely is kind of racist.
A little bit, but I think it's less of a problem than it's just awful opinion on what makes art and human beings.
Yeah, which is the same problem with Birdman.
Yes,
right? It's absolutely. Like, doesn't understand art.
Do you hate Birdman more than you hate this film?
I would have to watch Birdman again. When I was watching this, I was like, I thought Birdman was stupid. This is even stupider. Brad Pitt might make this better than Birdman. But Ed Norton's pretty good in Birdman.
I hate Birdman a lot more.
Okay.
Birdman is just as inept in pulling off its thesis, but its thesis is more egregious to me because it's just like, isn't it hard being in Hollywood?
Yeah.
And it just makes me want to be like, burn the industry down.
But not hard because, like, it's a kind of hulking capitalist structure. No. Hard because critics
are mean to you. Yeah. Fucking goddamn. It's one of the things that makes Iñárritu even more repellent to me. He made this film about how evil critics are. He got good critical notices. Like, no one really criticized Iñárritu. Yeah. He's been wildly successful. He's been, like, multiply Oscar nominated. All of his movies have made quite a lot of money. Like, this is not a man who struggles for want of really anything.
At least Babel doesn't have a subtitle, like, The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. That's...
I want to see how much Babel made.
It made a lot.
Did it?
Yeah, I looked this up when I was watching it. I think it made, like, 200 million, maybe 150.
135 million.
Okay.
Fa la la. It was also 7 Academy Award nominations.
Yeah, it only won for like sound editing or something.
Wow. What did it come up against?
It's a good question. What else
I'm finding
is it
out.
2006?
It just won score. The score is very good. Except for the racist Morocco part. It was the 79th Oscars. Oh. It was The Departed. The Departed.
Oh, I remember. Because that was Marty's first Oscar, right?
That's
insane.
Because
also The Departed is a pretty... For a Martin Scorsese film, I like The Departed.
I love The Departed. Are you going to be mean? No, I love The Departed.
I do like The Departed.
I think that's great. You think The Rat is your anti-The
Rat? No, I'm fine with The Rat. It's just all the accents.
Yeah, it's... I think it's... I like The Departed quite a lot. It's very silly.
It's fun.
But in a good way. Yeah, Best Picture... see, I remember this so clearly.
It's like not as good... Nowhere near as good as like... A handful of other Scorsese. Like,
no.
It does not Scorsese movies. Quite.
Like, yeah, but that's just because Scorsese has, like, made some films that no one else living has
taught.
Yeah,
that's true.
Like, Taxi Driver is just...
It's a league of its own.
It really is. Best Picture that year was... Yeah, I had little laminated posters for each of these. The Departed, which wins. Babel.
Yeah.
Letters from Iwo Jima.
Mel Gibson?
No, Clint Eastwood.
Oh, that's right.
Strongly remember rooting for because I loved Eastwood as a teenager.
Interesting.
One of my first cinematic loves was Sergio Leone spaghetti westerns.
Huh.
So I got into Eastwood that way, and then I loved Eastwood. I watched all of his movies. Little Miss Sunshine. Do you remember
that film?
What does that movie play like today?
Oh,
Very
confusing.
What happens to a new audience who watches Little Miss Sunshine?
That was a real narrow slice of kind of mumblecore-y indie cinema where you could, like, was Juno around that time as
well?
That's...
Little Miss Sunshine cost $8 million, makes $101 million. Like, yeah, a sensation.
Crazy.
Paul Dano. Paul Dano. It's Steve Carell, Tony Collette. Right. Fucking crazy.
That is a crazy... And it's...
Such silly things happen in that
The guy who's in Ocean's 11, the old...
Is he? No.
Is there a different old guy?
It's Alan Arkin.
Alan Arkin, who I always think is in Ocean's 11.
Yeah. Such silly things happen in that film. Like when they steal the dead body.
That's right.
Like, it's... It's...
Isn't it directed by a husband and wife team?
Yeah, who made Mississippi Grind with Ben Mendelsohn, which is really good. And then the other one nominated for Best Picture was The Queen.
I watched that on a plane, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, not bad. I really don't think bad.
Given all the... I mean, because it was about the Diana dying, right? Interesting.
Yeah. Written by Peter Morgan, whose whole fucking career is doing the Royals. He created The Crown.
For real?
Yeah. All he does is does the fucking Royals. He's Sir Peter Morgan as well.
And you've got to pay.
Yeah, it works out for you, doesn't it? The only other thing I want to say about the 79th Oscars is very important for me because the first and only Oscar won by George Miller, one of my favorite filmmakers, the director behind Mad Max, wins for Happy Feet.
Best animated feature.
Which I haven't seen.
Well, we'll be watching Happy Feet 2.
We'll be watching it, but not Happy Feet 1.
No.
I don't think we should. The only other thing to say is that Babel was written by Guillermo Arriaga, who basically, like, Iñárritu came to him with all of these ideas and said, like, Brianna is very slowly walking past, making a face. You can say hello. How is unemployed life? The last episode of the podcast you were on, you had just been made redundant.
You're really sticking to your schedule.
Yeah, we're charting your journey through employment. You're currently in your pajamas, so, like, it's going okay.
Yeah. I mean, what have I achieved in the last week?
You've painted so much.
Yeah, I've done a bit of painting, and I'm proud to say that today was the first time, after a year of working from home, doing Zoom calls from home, it was the first time all year that I accidentally walked naked in front of
Jai's
team meeting.
Yeah.
Rough stuff.
Yeah. It was very stressful for both of us.
Do you think they noticed?
They told me that they didn't.
I bet you they fucking did.
Can you say that you did in that situation? Can you be like, yeah, I think someone would say...
I think surely someone would say, be like, yes.
Yeah, because like, what can you do? I think they would say yes.
Okay.
I'm trying to think what's...
I'm pretty sure you didn't, because you came at a weird angle. It's possible that you just weren't visible.
This is what happens. You move into your house as a couple and you're like, excellent. Yeah. You have to walk around naked.
Yeah, I know. I do have one meeting a day at the same time every day.
Well, this is what you've been spun out by unemployment.
I don't have a schedule now. I'm unemployed.
Yeah,
you know?
I guess that's it. So Iñárritu comes up with the idea and brings it to Guillermo Arriaga, who actually writes the screenplay.
Okay.
And it's worth saying that I think Arriaga is a talented screenwriter with a weird...
Yeah, this script scene is uneven, I think.
It is.
Like, I feel like Cate Blanchett's character is given very little to work with.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone is kind of given not very much to do. But he writes The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. Have you seen that film? Directed by Tommy Lee Jones. Super, super good.
Oh.
Like an excellent movie about a man whose friend gets shot by a racist. And who makes the racist dig up the body of the friend who he shot and takes him to be buried in his home place. So it's like gunpoint. So it's like, it could be very silly, like, you know, teaching a racist how to be human.
Sure, Green Book.
Exactly. But with the corpse in tow. It really tries to, it does different things with that premise. And it has a superb ending. So I think he's talented. Famously, he and Iñárritu fall out after this movie.
Oh, is it known why? They just stop making
things
together.
They hate each other. They really hate each other.
And is it to do with this movie?
I assume so. But who knows what? Because Arriaga was nominated for an Oscar for the screenplay. So, but yeah, he directs movies of his own, but they do nothing. Like, that you won't even know. The Burning Plain which stars Charlize Theron and Jennifer Lawrence, so massive names, but nobody knows it. Made $5 million, so nothing. And then in 2015, he makes a movie called From Afar, which makes $148,000 at the box office. So, oof, blood, dish. Do you want to talk about Babel?
I've never seen it.
Cate Blanchett is in it.
She's in pain almost the whole time. She's shot at the beginning, and then she's just in agony. It's rough, kind of all the. There's a scene where they like stitch her wound shut that I had a bit of trouble with.
It's also reasonably well done though, the way that the kids kind of shoot and you don't hear anything. The bullet just comes through the window. It's like quite well. The sound mixing is great. She's just leaning against the window, and it kind of just goes like very quiet.
You'd imagine because it's a 20. It's like a rifle from a long way away.
That they kind of fire at random, we should say. They don't even really fire it at the bus, right? Or do they?
No, he does. He decides to fire it at the bus because they're like... The two kids are just having a conversation about how far the bullets could go.
Sure.
And then it's like, I bet you couldn't hit the bus. I bet I could. He's like, they shoot. Oh, you didn't hit it. And then you see the bus pulling up. And then later you go and... I mean, that's the thing about this film is the time stuff is just so boring.
Like, it doesn't...
Who cares that it's out of sync?
Yeah. Is there any film that's well done, like a time...
I mean, Pulp Fiction, right?
I guess so. Does Pulp Fiction do it good? Maybe I actually think one of the best is...
Primer?
Saw 2.
Okay.
Saw 2, the twist is you're cross-cutting between a house with people with, like... all these traps, and you're cross-cutting with the cops trying to find them.
Oh, that's fun.
And the cops are looking at VHS footage, and the cops eventually find out where the house is, and they run to go and save the people, and you're cross-cutting between the people.
Yeah.
They're at like they're drowning in a tank, and they're trying to get out of the tank, and the cops are on the way, and the cops burst in, and the cops burst into the house, and there's a bunch of dead people who are completely rotted and decomposed in a tank. And you realize that there's been a massive time discrepancy.
That's pretty good.
That the cops are in the present and the people are way in the past.
That's. I feel like I've seen other films do that.
Silence of the Lambs.
Okay, which I haven't seen
Damn. Yeah, it's not original, but every time I see it, I'm like, it's fun. I always.
It's great. No, I'm tricked.
Mm-hmm.
Like Babel, the time stuff is. Time stuff is also kind of cursory. Like they make gestures to it two or three times. Never really matters.
Like, everything in this film, who cares?
Yeah.
It's never an important plot point. It's just the kind of thing that you do to draw attention to yourself as a filmmaker.
If you was given this script and tasked with punching it up, what would you do? Like, what does this film need? Because I feel like the characters aren't interesting. The form is always... so showy that it obscures anything that's happening. Like, what makes this film more interesting? Or what makes this film worth watching?
I think, and this sounds crazy given some of the criticisms that we've leveled against this film, I think I strip it out for all but two stories. I strip out the story set in Japan, and I strip out the kids in Morocco, and I make it a narrative that is half Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett, and then it resets, and we see the exact same thing from the point of view of the maid. And that would give an opportunity, I think, to really hone and clarify both of those stories and make them more interesting and give you this grand theme of, like, cross-communication. And you could really burrow into the class stuff, which this film doesn't care
about.
And maybe that's still... I don't think that's a great film, because actually, to be honest, I don't know if there's a way to make this a great film.
I think one thing that would allow to, that is that one thing that would permit that would stop this, like that would prevent one of the reasons that I think this is what maybe the worst film I've ever seen is the lack of characterization of the maid.
Mm.
So you're essentially watching like the scene when she's lost in the desert is brutal. She's kind of left there by this guy who was drunk driving and like left there with the kids in this kind of awful, heartless confluence of events. And she is so upset, and then she gets deported. And it's like, well, terrible things happen to people. And you can absolutely show me terrible things happening to people, but, like, give me something about the value of the person in that. And it feels like the only reason we should be upset for her is because she's upset. When truly awful, like, of course I should have... Like, and I distance myself from her because it's so painful to be at all involved. But I'm also given no reason to be involved, so the distancing is easy.
Yeah.
And if more time was spent with that story, if I... Like... I left the film being like, unsure, well, why did she really need to go to that wedding? Why was that so important? I guess it was a relative or something, but I didn't really pick up on that. Did she have a good time at the wedding? Was it that important for her?
Yeah.
Like, why was this? Why did this guy choose to drive her back, who she didn't really trust? None of that is clear to me. Maybe it was evident in the film and I just missed it.
No.
But
it's underwritten.
It's so underwritten, and it really lets down the movie.
Yeah, it's underwritten in a way that all you can really see and focus on is the pain and the tragedy. And you just don't really want to focus on
it. No, because, like, why should, like, give me a reason to focus on pain and tragedy?
Yeah, for quite a long time.
It's also not entertaining.
No.
Even.
And the final shot is awful, terrible. It's
just a slow zoom out from the Tokyo apartment building.
Yeah. Why end on her?
Which is why, like, oh, because her father gave the gun to this guy that took him on a good hunting trip. We don't really know about the father, apart from that, his wife, the girl's mother, died. She, for some reason, tells the cop that she jumped off the building. In fact, she shot herself. Well, that's what the father says, at least. And then they're both sad because she tried to seduce the policeman in a really clunky and upsetting way that is only seems to be played because, like, Inarita takes her to be stupid because she's deaf.
Yeah.
Like, what is the way? Because it's not even that much about miscommunication at that point.
No.
And, like, there's a moment where you think the father, you're seeing things from the point of view of the father coming home and he thinks maybe his daughter has killed herself by jumping off the building, but in fact she's just standing naked on the balcony. It plays as if it thinks it's so meaningful.
It's arbitrary. That's what I think the big problem is. The ending just makes everything feel so arbitrary.
But, like, the slow, like, the time it takes with it is like, oh,
yeah.
Haven't we? We've arrived. Just like, what?
Yeah, at what?
Who cares?
It's ponderous. It's
ponderous is a great adjective to describe this film.
Do you hate this film more than Ocean's 12?
Ocean's 12 was in some ways more infuriating to watch. This. At least Ocean's 12 was self-important in a way that was just spectacularly unearned. This is self-important and cruel in a way that is spectacularly unearned. It's redeemed a little bit by the performance of Brad Pitt, which is good to great. And he doesn't have great material to work with, but he has real heart in his eyes. There's that scene, again, like super white savior bullshit.
The letterboxed header is him on the phone crying.
Yeah, but it's the iconic scene from the film. Where a man who helped him in the village, as he's leaving on the helicopter with Kate to go to the hospital, he tries to thrust money into his hand and the man refuses. Again, corny scene, but Brad plays it. A whole host of emotions go through his face and you understand his decisions in that moment. His, like, initial forcing and then his decision to, like, step back. That stuff is good, but oh boy did I... If... This is a kind of a crazy thing to say, but, you know, I think this way sometimes, I suppose. If films were people, this is the one I'd like least and least trust. I do not trust this film.
Are you sure?
And I think this film thinks it's better than me in a way that maybe nothing... Like, give me Dark Side of the Sun any day.
Oh, 100%. Dark Side of the Sun is a masterpiece compared to this.
I
hate Ocean's 12 more.
Okay, why? I don't think that's a crazy thing to say.
I think I just find... Ocean's 12 much harder to sit through. I found that movie so hard to sit through.
I watched Babel in two chunks. I think I watched Ocean's 12 in like 18.
Yeah.
Maybe literally.
I think that was really hard.
Babel's a 2-hour, 15-minute film. Doesn't feel that long. Ocean's 12 felt like a 6-hour.
Absolutely. Slot. Ocean's 12 is so smug. And this film is thinks itself to be important, but it...
Smug in parts,
but it doesn't have the winky kind of quality, and I think I hate that a lot.
The cruelty is just very difficult for me to bear.
Sure. But you know what I mean? I'm glad to hear you say it, because it is something that I think that, like, people who will say... People like Roger Ebert, who look down their nose at horror movies...
Absolute bullshit.
This movie is way more morally depraved than horror movies. Yes,
I could not agree with you more. Almost all horror movies.
Yeah.
Certainly all the ones I've seen.
It's torture porn in a really serious way.
Which, at least... Not that I've... I mean, I don't know if I've ever watched a torture porn film in my life, but at least they don't dress themselves up as something else.
Yeah.
At least they're perfectly... At least the human centipede is perfectly honest about what it is.
Humans tend to be a pretty good movie.
This wants to be, like, an object of intellectual critique and interest.
It's surely disappeared in the culture, right? I don't hear anyone talk about this movie, do you?
No. No. I don't think so. Which is interesting because Inarritu is now like a major figure who presumably could do basically whatever he wants.
Absolutely.
So I'm sure it is interesting that this, as kind of his first major American film, or like, I know it's a 21
grams, but that.
Oh yeah, 21 grams. Like, that's true. But it's like as a film that was nominated for 7 Oscars not that long ago, I certainly never hear anyone talk about it.
What? I'm trying to see if he's got a film coming up. Oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear about his 2017 Cannes Film Festival premiering VR short film in which you put on VR goggles and you, quote unquote, got plunged into the harsh life of an immigrant? So, imagine.
Empathy machine.
Yes, exactly. It was. A lot of people had a lot of problems with that film. You can imagine. It's very Don DeLillo. We keep invoking him, but rich people swanning around the Cannes Film Festival, putting on headsets and imagining what it would be like if their life was worse.
What was the Haneke film? Happy something.
Happy End.
Happy End. Yeah, kind of that vibe. Mm. The like extremely wealthy, except not being condemned. Yes. That's a good film.
I love that film. People say Haneke's maybe retired.
Oh, that's sad.
He's old.
Yeah. He made films I haven't seen. I was thinking actually about a Haneke film, Cachet, when you were talking about, spoiler alert for Cachet, Sean Penn shooting himself all of a sudden. Cachet does that very well.
Wow! I saw that at the cinema, because really? I think it came out like 2005. For those who haven't seen it, I'll leave it vague, because you really should go and see Cachet. But someone goes to kind of confront someone, and someone just... slits their wrists. That, is that wrist or their neck? I think it's their neck. And just blood just plumes up the wall.
That film, nothing like that in that film prepares you for that moment.
No, it's just, he's there. It's like French people having quiet conversations in rooms. And then someone just like...
Which is so Haneke.
It works so well. I love that film.
It's a good film.
I really have to watch it again. Another one that Sight and Sound really championed that I first read about in Sight and Sound. I just want to know about, I just want you to know this sentence from Inarritu's opening blurb on Wikipedia.
Mm.
Inarritu is known for telling international stories about the human condition.
Yes.
And his projects have garnered critical acclaim and numerous accolades. Just absolutely fuck off.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, in the deepest way, fuck off.
Human condition.
I know. Letterboxd game?
Yes, please.
3.6.
I can already feel my stomach shriveling up at the 5-star.
I'll go to the 5-star in a minute. I'll read you some of this one first.
Okay.
It's a review by someone called Darren. Their top 4 films are... a bunch of them I haven't seen. The Story of the Last Chrysanthemum by Mizoguchi.
Hmm.
Very famous Japanese director. I haven't seen it. Everyone thinks it's a masterpiece. Citizen Kane. Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Not quite as good as Meet the Feebles, but you know, a few things in the world are. Apocalypse Now.
Great film.
We always talk about that film for some reason. Yeah. Have you seen it?
I don't know.
An Inn in Tokyo, directed by Ozu. Yoshiru Ozu, another Japanese director who is a real blind spot for me. 2.5-star review of Babel. What a load of wank. Babel adds up to nothing. Stuff happens, but nothing really happens, and it all means nothing. Babel strikes me as really vapid. It is an excuse to make a globe-trotting film about pain across borders and human barriers, or some other tagline that can be thrown around as the supposed artistic intent of the piece. The back of my DVD case reads, "Pain is universal, but so is hope." Why the fuck not? That may as well be what this all comes to. It is just a film with 4 stories that barely connect, and some aspiration that we find some commonality between them.
Yeah. Why 2.5 stars then?
I don't know. Far too generous. What do you want? Do you want some more half stars before we prepare? Yeah. Do you want it the lowest?
The real lowest, yeah.
This one's pretty good. So this person's name is Nick. Their top 4 films are The Cruise, which is a documentary by Bennett Miller, who we will talk about soon because Miller directs Moneyball. He's like a pretty good director. He made Moneyball. He made Foxcatcher. Have you seen Foxcatcher with Steve Carell?
The wrestling film.
Yeah, good. Haven't seen it. Okay. Really good film. And he made Capote. Have you seen that?
I have seen that film. Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yeah, I like that film.
He was also... Wasn't he married to an Olsen twin?
Oh.
I think he was.
That's interesting.
Yeah, they broke up quite recently. And according to Letterboxd, he's making a fucking Christmas Carol?
Sure, why not? We need one more.
Just do whatever you want to do. And yeah, he made this documentary that I've never seen that came out in 1998 called The Cruise, which is about a tour guide for Manhattan's Grey Line double-decker buses.
That sounds interesting.
It does sound interesting. I bet it would be pretty good. The other top four films are Along the Coast, which is a short film by Agnes Varda. Have you seen any Varda?
Yeah, I've seen
Cleo.
Cleo 9 to 5, which is a masterpiece.
You liked it?
I recently watched her Black Panther documentary, which is a lot of fun.
That is good.
That might be it. I know there are a lot on Criterion at the moment. My dad loves The Gleaners.
Sure.
Yeah.
I quite like The Gleaners. Very sad.
Okay.
But, good. Varda's always good. The Young Girls of Rochefort. Have you seen that?
No.
Directed by Jacques Demy. You would really like Demy. Okay. Actually, no, because you saw Whatchamahoozie and you didn't like it so much.
Tell me.
You saw the one where they're all singing. Umbrellas. Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
It's a
crazy film. No, I didn't. I didn't dislike that.
Okay.
I just thought it was insane.
It's definitely insane.
Yeah, I think about that film a lot.
Really? Just because people sing every line of dialogue?
Yeah, but not. It's also so weirdly colourful. No, I do like that film.
Okay.
I'm fixated on that film in some way, I think.
I blame it for bringing La La Land into the world.
Oh, interesting. Which I haven't seen.
Mm, so, you know, a great evil was unleashed when it came into the world. And
But Chazelle, he's going to have our boy Brad.
Maybe.
Okay.
Right? We haven't heard anything about that project since the pandemic yet.
Yeah, that's probably true. It is mentioned at the bottom. You sent me an article about Brad and David Fincher watching movies together, and at the bottom of that it lists it as one of Brad's upcoming projects.
It does.
But that might just be old news anyway.
The fourth favourite film is Daisies. Do you know that film?
No.
You would really like that. Czech New Wave feminist punk film.
Cool.
Just like very fun from 1966. Like very silly and surreal. Really good. I love Daisies. A great film. And this person's review with those four films is, I'd been curious about Babel for years, and now that I've seen it, contender for one of the worst movies of all time.
Yeah.
Visually compelling and well acted, with the emotional depth of a puddle in the sun.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty true.
That's definitely true.
Someone else just gave it 0.5 star and said, this shit sucks. This film was abysmal. It's depressing, but in a way that's totally invented. All these shitty things happen end on end. It doesn't even work as every single character is deeply unlikable, bar the nanny and the teenage girl, who still have major issues, but at least can be slightly identified with.
Brad's not that unlikable. And I don't think I just say that because of my affinity. No. He's a man who is immediately put under enormous stress and does his best.
When it's him and Kate arguing at the beginning, I can imagine just being like, oh, yeah. Fucking hell.
There's also that sweet scene where they kiss, which is kind of nice.
It's also very memorable. For some reason, it really sticks out in my head that Kate orders a Coke. Or does she order a Diet Coke?
And they don't have it, I think.
And with no ice.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the ice because you get sick from the tap water.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
apparently.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I just got a notification that Hillbilly Elegy has now hit Netflix.
The best
movie of the year, apparently.
I've heard people not like that.
Have you seen the trailer?
Yes, it does not look good.
With the
Ron Howard, right?
Yeah, the talk about like a good Terminators, bad Terminators, and neutral Terminators.
Right, the grandmother's like telling, oh boy.
It looks awful.
It does not look good. It was a book that everyone was super into for like 20 seconds before people started being like, wait a second.
What the fuck is going on here? Grubber. This person's top four films are extremely letterboxed. And I don't mean that in an entirely disparaging way, but The Grand Budapest Hotel.
My least favourite Wes Anderson film.
Mine too.
His worst film.
Your Name. I've never seen that film. Okay. But people love it. Do you know about it?
I think maybe.
It's the Body Swap anime film.
Came
out in 2016.
Yeah, people do like that. I didn't know it was a Body Swap film.
I have to sit down and finally watch it. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
I like that film more than you do.
I know.
It's fun. I had a fun time.
It's okay.
Okay.
It's nice to look at. But it's slightly
John
vapid.
In it.
Yeah, that's... And Nicolas Cage.
That's right. Nicolas Cage is actually quite sensitive in that film.
Yeah, he does a great job. He's always good.
Yeah, unimpeachable.
And La La Land.
Oh, not seen.
And their review. Gross and weird and slow and boring and overdramatic and annoying. I don't think I've ever groaned so much during a movie. Utter garbage.
Yeah.
Should we have one low rating and then a 5-star?
That sounds good. One thing I just quickly want to say is, like, Into the Spider-Verse, a film I enjoy, a film that I think someone is insane to put in their top four. That's kind of how I feel about that film.
It's very popular.
It's like, real B+, maybe.
I
like,
can
real
imagine.
Three and a half, like, oh, great, I wanted a 3.5-star film this evening, and that's what I got, you know?
I can imagine. I really genuinely don't say this in a disparaging way, although maybe it will sound slightly patronizing. I can imagine being 16 years old and just thinking, like, Into the Spider-Verse is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it's not because I don't find it that way because I've seen more movies or something stupid like that. I just think if you've come of age in a comic book culture, you're so versed in the language of comic books, and then you see something be that original and distinct and interesting while still trading in a language that you have basically grown up with. I think
it could be
awe-inspiring.
It's Ready Player One for people who like BoJack Horseman. Right?
Yes. Sounds mean, but maybe
I
just because
like
I hate both of those projects.
Yeah.
But sure.
But, like, it's a cartoon that people are like, oh, wow, this is self-reflexive. And, like, it knows it's a cartoon.
The best thing
but
about...
it's doing the Ready Player One thing of, like, you recognize these things? What if they were different?
The best thing about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is how big the Kingpin is. I love
that's
that they
right.
just lean in and they're like, this guy is big.
But that's all the good stuff about that film, right? It's like, we're just going to do the thing.
Yeah.
Which is, can get tiresome, but...
Which is
probably going to be a sequel. That's a shame, but you know.
It's crazy because that's what makes comic books good.
Yeah.
It's so funny that comic book culture has become so boring.
Yeah.
Like, what...
Everyone needs to be ripped and in, like, costumes that are, like, grey.
Yes. What I love about comic books is they're fucking crazy. They do the crazy thing. And, yeah.
Because you're allowed to.
Yeah. It took coming back via Into the Spider-Verse for people to realise that. Tanner is this person. And a really interesting top four films.
Mm-hmm.
Trois Colors Blue.
Oh, one of my posters on my wall.
That you haven't seen.
That I haven't seen. I think, actually, maybe I've seen one of those films. I don't remember which one, though.
Red is my favourite.
Okay.
I think white is pretty bad, and blue is pretty boring.
Okay.
But red is kind of cool. And weirdly makes the others seem better in my memory.
Hmm.
If blue was the only one that existed, or white was the only one existed, I would be like, these movies suck.
Sure.
Hard not to see Three Colors Blue and not think of a joke from one of my favourite TV series of all time, The League of Gentlemen. Do you know this?
Never seen it. I do know of it, but British, right?
Very grim British horror comedy TV series that has a bunch of, like, film nerds.
Yeah.
And they speak in a very silly voice, and they're always talking about Trois Colors Bleu, which is very funny. In the Mood for Love.
Oh, Wong Kar-wai.
Wong Kar-wai.
Great film.
Did you see... I have to show it to you now. I know we're running tight on time.
How are we doing? Oh, yeah. We're okay, but yeah.
I have to show you this photo that I saw the other day of...
The collars in that film are unbelievable.
The collars or the
that,
collars?
The woman's collars. Literally collars.
Yeah. They are.
On all her dresses.
Mubi just posted this photo of Wong Kar-wai himself.
Oh.
Such a chiller.
Yeah.
Such
Adidas
a chiller. It's
sweatshirt.
Him in an Adidas tracksuit with a white shirt underneath and his distinctive glasses. He always wears sunglasses.
I gotta get a bit.
Yeah, you do gotta get a bit, Dan. It's very freeing.
Some slightly
to
weird
have
glasses
a bit
that I can just always wear.
Yeah.
I've been thinking of getting new. I'm going back to Brisbane over Christmas and gotta get my eyes checked. Might get some new weird frames.
What
we'll
are you
see.
Thinking?
Something thicker than what I have.
Aviators?
No. Too standard. I think I just want to, you know, this is I've begun shaving my head recently.
Mm.
You know who has a shaved head and has really good glasses?
Who?
Stanley Tucci. He has excellent frames. They're probably like $900.
Sure. So you're thinking of leaning into the Tucci.
Yeah.
It's a little bit... Because you've shaved your head and you've grown your beard out a little bit. It's a little bit, to me, Oscar Isaac in Ex Machina. Have you seen that movie?
Does he have glasses in that?
No, he does not.
I'm okay with that look, though.
He does not. But he has a bigger beard. So if you continue to grow out your beard...
Okay, I could do that.
You just couldn't do circles, right? Because then you would just be Bob Balaban.
Yeah. I mean, there are worse things to be.
That's certainly in your eyes, I know. The other of these top four films, 2001 A Space Odyssey.
It's a good film. I like it more than you.
Yeah, it's okay. And Alien. It's begging for your attention.
Yeah, I'm going to... It's happening.
It's a Christmas episode.
Yeah.
This review. I watched this movie 10 years ago. It is one of the most offensively masturbatory, nihilistic heaps of misanthropic bullshit ever put to screen. Fuck this movie. Fuck all his movies. Fuck him.
Okay. I mean, I don't love the ad hominem, but I agree.
I love the ad hominem. Yeah. It's what I think. You want some 5 stars?
It's funny that I don't love the ad hominem because I do so associate people with art, you know. Give me the 5 stars.
This 5-star just says everyone is connected.
That's what the film wants. It's like, well, don't we do that 5 stars because everyone is connected? That's the film's premise.
Yeah.
It's argument.
I was weeping by the end. Oh. Inaritu is a god. What is the top 4 of the person who calls Inaritu a god?
Better have some Inaritu films in there.
Empire Strikes Back, Pulp Fiction, Rocky and the Dark Knight.
The fact that people can exist in the world and do that unironically is transcendent to me. You can be sufficiently unaware of the discourse around that type of guy.
Yeah.
And you do that sincerely. Yeah. Astonishing.
Rocky is probably the most character-breaking one of those. Yeah,
but it's still like all those posters on a dorm room wall, you know. So funny. Also, actually, I haven't seen Rocky, but fine films. That's the other thing. It's like, I like The Dark Knight.
Oh my God.
Tell me.
Am I going to get in trouble for speaking this aloud? So, you can tell me if we should edit this out. One of my favourite things to stumble across in a Letterboxd game, someone who's logged one movie, it's Babel.
Yeah.
Their username is Huge Pubic Bone. That should give you a taste of what we're about to discover here. One, no other activity. Look. Films 1, diary 1, reviews 1, likes 1.
Okay.
They came on this app on the 26th of October, so
this year.
A month ago.
Uh-huh.
Did this one thing and were like, that's it. Their review of Babel. You really get your money's worth of hairy vagina with this one.
Whoa. Because you do.
So what?
But also what interests me about that is you would think someone who that was their thing...
Would do
more films with it. Because this is not the only film.
Do you think they were like, hey, that's a funny joke, but they then couldn't think of any...
It is, because that's... We didn't... The Japanese girl exposes herself several times in this film.
Yeah. What a crazy thing to have happened. This Letterboxd review.
Yeah, wow. This is this is what is uncovered. Bradford House exclusive.
Yes.
No one else is doing this.
No.
Huh.
The Poetic Critic. So their bio says, in the spirit of the Reviews in Rhyme website of the 1990s,
oh boy.
Get ready, and everyone who's ever taken to verse to describe a Dr. Seuss adaptation, my reviews all double as poetry.
I hope this person's reviewed the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. That is a masterpiece. Dr. Seuss's one film.
Yeah, Theodore Geisel's. Is he credited as Theodore Geisel or Dr. Seuss?
I think Theodore Geisel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Is he problematic, Theodore Geisel?
Maybe. I feel like... I'm not qualified to comment.
Because you ruined Roald Dahl for me, so I was wondering if you were ready to ruin...
He's a Nazi sympathiser.
I wondered if you were going to ruin Dr.
Seuss.
No,
I think Dr. Seuss is fine.
This person's top 4 films. Being There. Have you seen that film? Hal Ashby, Peter Sellers.
Oh, no.
You would really like
that. I watched a documentary about Hal Ashby, and it showed a lot of Being There. I haven't seen any of his films.
No, though. I remember. We discovered this on air. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
The Gene... What's his name?
Gene Wilder.
Gene Wilder one, yeah.
David Cronenberg's The Fly.
Haven't seen it.
Great film. And Beauty and the Beast.
The Disney one?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is written in, like, haiku form. Never-ending story, or things are tough all over, draining yet graceful.
See, the thing about that is it's someone who cares exclusively about form. Again, right? It's like... I'm going to write all reviews in poetry. Why? Don't know. Because poetry? That's the problem with Babel, is it's, or Babel, or whatever this stupid film is called.
Yeah. Is it?
It's the same level of intellectual idea.
Yeah.
As why don't I write film reviews that... It doesn't even rhyme!
Should we end with this one? You got to go.
Sorry.
Top 4 films. Memento.
Fine film.
The Shawshank Redemption.
Haven't seen it.
Jackie Brown.
The one Tarantino I haven't seen.
Probably the best. You should watch that before Tarantino comes gliding into our lives.
That would be great.
And National Treasure: Book of Secrets.
I respect that. I have seen that film.
Yeah, it's good.
Okay. I don't... It was a while ago.
Okay.
Like, I was staying with my cousin and...
And watched National.
We hired it. Yeah, I was like, a bit too old, probably.
I think that's a good film. I think to truly understand this film, you have to watch it with an open mind.
I feel like maybe I did. But it really shut.
I think I did too. You think it shut?
When did it shut?
Yeah. How quickly were you like, this is not for me?
Maybe. When it just spent a lot... And this is my piercing phobia. When it just spent a lot of time on the scene where Cate Blanchett was yelling that she didn't want to have her wound stitched up. And Brad was being like, no, it has to be. And she's in a kind of... No anesthetic is available. And she's screaming.
You're just like, please don't do it.
I'm like, why am I being... Again, I can take horrible things. I genuinely can. I think there is justification to have them in art sometimes. But it's like, what are we here for?
You know who famously used that argument against Blue Velvet?
Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
But that film has such profound meaning. I spend so much time establishing a world in which that makes sense.
You just think he's just... He can't cotton on to what it's doing. It is doing something.
I think so.
World's Wrongest Man.
Almost, yeah, certainly.
There will probably be a day where... I mean, if you like Tree of Life, you and Roger will be...
On the same page?
Simpatico.
Okay.
I didn't say that right.
You got close. Simpatico, I think.
Simpatico. who knows, maybe he'll like Megamind or something and we'll love Megamind. I think he liked Moneyball. So we, you know.
Yeah, but also like Broken Clock.
Yeah, and also everyone likes Moneyball. Yeah. Show me the person who doesn't like Moneyball and I'll show you a liar. Look how old my dog looks.
She's having a rest.
She's schlapping.
Yeah.
We will see you next time.
Yes. Maybe Christmas episode? Maybe not.
Or Mank. It'll be Mank or Christmas.
Yeah. It sounds like a threat.
Yeah. Listen.
It's going to be Mank or Christmas.
If you kids don't behave yourself, it's going to be Mank for everybody.
Email us at thebradpittcast@gmail.com.
Rate, review, and subscribe.
Rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, now Spotify. Can you? I don't think you can. Listen.
You can subscribe on Spotify.
Okay.
That helps our numbers.
Follow Brad Pittcast on Twitter. Tweet at us.
Yeah.
Check out our ever-changing roster of... Curated by Joe, Brad Pitt...
Avatars. Include... And also, a photo of the two of us up on the recently. Twitter account.
Beautiful.
Maybe the first photo ever taken
in the wild.
Yeah. And I think we're going to try and do Mank next time, yeah. Right? Yeah.
The next Pitt film is 13, Ocean's 13, I think.
Yeah, it is.
And then it gets... good.
Yeah.
For a while.
Oh, Ocean's 13.
I know. I mean, it's got to be better than Ocean's 12, right?
Let's get a guest, maybe. We haven't had a guest in a while. And we can just have someone kind of give us some pep in our step.
Because the third Ocean.
Yeah. Like as Andy Garcia comes back into the fold and becomes the 13th Ocean, we need someone to kind of reinvigorate the team. Yeah, it's Brad Pittcast 3. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sorry for listening to two episodes in a row where the film was not very well liked. But I think sometimes people like it when we're mean about movies.
And at least we're on the same page broadly about both of them, I think. People get upset when we fight.
When we fight. They do. We never fight.
No, definitely not. Some mild conflict.
Yeah, which is good.
Disagreement. You need it.
Exactly.
It's the essence of drama.
Exactly.
Inarritu
needs to learn this.
Yeah. Thank you all so much for listening.
See you next time.
See you next time.